Thank you for joining us. I'm Scott Schiff with Atlas Society's senior fellow, Rob Trzynski. I'd ask everyone to share the room and to please raise your hand if you want to join the conversation. Our CEO, Jennifer Grossman, is here as well. I also want to note that Rob and our other scholars will be speaking during the day at our gala in Malibu, October 6th, and I'll put up a link for tickets. Rob, thanks so much for doing this topic. What do we need for a new enlightenment?
Well, yeah, let's talk about, first of all, why would we want a new enlightenment? Why are we talking about the idea of a new enlightenment? Well, today's topic was inspired by the fact that there are, and for the last 5 years or so, there have been a number of different people out there talking about the legacy of the Enlightenment and defending the legacy of the Enlightenment and proposing it as a solution or an answer to today's problems. So this sort of kicked off, I think it was about 5 years ago. You had, 4 years ago, 2018, that there were several different books, prominent books that came out talking about the Enlightenment. There was Steven Pinker did Enlightenment Now. Jonah Goldberg, that's at the, on the center left, Steven Pinker did Enlightenment Now. On the center right, Jonah Goldberg did, I can't remember what the think
liberal what, fascism.
No. This was a much more recent one. Something like it had this weird title, like the Death of the West, Suicide of the West. That was the name of it. The Suicide of the West, which is an overly dramatic title, probably because his publishers thought that would sell better. But it's really about the Enlightenment and its impact and why, and trying to reclaim the legacy of the Enlightenment. I also have heard somebody kicking around the phrase Enlightenment 2.0, which sort of implies that we should have a reboot of the Enlightenment or a new and improved version of the Enlightenment. And I think this is a great idea. I think this is a terrific idea because it is absolutely true that we live in a world shaped by the Enlightenment. Now, what do we mean by the Enlightenment? It's a name used mostly after the fact to refer to the intellectual movement of the 18th century. Now, the Enlightenment is usually regarded as beginning with Locke and Newton in the late 1600s, so very late 17th century. 1689, Newton publishes the Principia, which is his great work on physics. 1689, Locke publishes the two treatises on government. And this is sort of kicking off the movement, intellectual movement of the Enlightenment, which lasts through the 18th century. But it is the intellectual movement that sort of created the modern world. And it includes things like a regard for science and reason as offering, basic answers to the big questions of human life as offering guidance for action and for our worldview. So a scientific worldview, and also an individualist worldview, an idea that that individuals should be allowed to pursue their own interests and make their own decisions, leading to the development of the concept of natural rights or individual rights. That was Locke's big contribution at the end of the 17th century, which took off and became implemented in many different ways in the 18th century, especially in the American Revolution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights. All of that stuff is, an implementation of this Enlightenment idea of the individual and the rights of the individual and the autonomy of the individual being at the center of politics and of morality. And then, as well as the fact that the same time at which free market economics is basically invented and begins to be used to explain the world. And so the idea of a free society, a society with representative government, and also a society with relative freedom, economic freedom, is really born out of the Enlightenment. And so you can see how this totally shapes the modern world, the world of capitalism, the world of individualism, the world of individual autonomy, that ideal of an individual autonomy. and of a scientific and technological society that is, you know, human life has been totally transformed by all of the science and technology, the implementation of that to industry that happened subsequent to and as a consequence of this intellectual movement, the Enlightenment. So obviously this is, you know, this is something that made the modern world that has made a dramatic improvement in human life. So the idea is there's been a number of people sort of hearkening back to that in the current context and saying we need to return to the ideals of the Enlightenment. Now, the topic I want to take on today is based on the agreeing with that part of it. I absolutely agree with every part of that, except for the one implication that you often get in these things is the idea that we need to return to the ideas of the Enlightenment, that the ideas of the Enlightenment, the existing intellectual frame, is perfectly adequate. We don't really need to change it. And we just need to sort of rediscover it and return back and study. We need to study the Enlightenment and turn. Enlightenment are basically here. And so, you know, we don't need anything new. And I think we absolutely do need some things that are new. So I think, you know, one of the things I want to talk, when I talk about it, you know, I like this phrase Enlightenment 2.0, emphasize the idea that this is 2.0. It is going, if we want to reclaim the legacy of the Enlightenment, we're also going to have to be open to the idea that there are things that need to be fixed in the Enlightenment, and that we need to have some new ideas and some changes and modifications required to put the Enlightenment on a firmer footing. I want to talk a little bit about what those things are, and I think there's like three big things I'm going to throw out here. But then I want to end by talking the fact about the mindset that is required to go back to
Cutting out just a little bit.
Yeah, I gotta move. It's a little sensitive to your exact. Let me stand over here. Is this better?
Yes.
Okay.
Wait, no, it's not.
Was that?
You cut out for another second again, right after you said. Okay.
Oh, yeah, right after I said that's better.
Right.
Makes sense. All right. So, well, let's go over the things that I think need to be fixed about the Enlightenment. So one of the places I'm talking about is, you know, like Stephen Pinker is a good example. You know, the funny thing at the time these books came out, I did reviews of them, and I found it very interesting that, you know, Stephen Pinker and Jonah Goldberg both wrote books about the legacy of the Enlightenment and all the progress we've made since the Enlightenment and how what we can learn from the Enlightenment. And the funny thing is, Stephen Pinker basically comes up with the conclusion that the Enlightenment coheres completely with a standard, you know, down the line center left viewpoint, contemporary center left viewpoint. And Jonah Goldberg looks at the Enlightenment and basically derives from it standard issue late 20th century conservatism. Right, so it's very interesting that, you know, the Enlightenment was a big and varied intellectual movement. It had elements of both of those things in it. So it's very easy for somebody to look at that and say, yes, the Enlightenment was great. Let me pick the elements from the Enlightenment that cohere directly to my standard issue right of center or left of center worldview. But Pinker is a great example of someone who I think has this sort of attitude that, well, all the ideas are there, and we all the existing ideas, anything new or anything to be changed, we'll just go with what, you know, what the conventional it's underestimating the fact that, you know, there's a reason why the Enlightenment didn't last. There was a backlash against the Enlightenment, and there were certain key intellectual weaknesses that need to be addressed if we're going to have an Enlightenment 2.0. So there's two big things I want to talk about. Then a third one that's perhaps a little more subtle. The first one is one of the reasons the Enlightenment didn't last. People who are the big Enlightenment philosophers, one of the big answers you will get is Immanuel Kant. because he's a late 18th century philosopher. He talked a lot about reason. And he actually wrote an essay called What is Enlightenment? In which he sort of positioned himself as one of the supporters of the Enlightenment. You know, this is late in the process where they're actually starting to use that term and gain this sort of self-awareness of this movement. And he positioned himself as an advocate of Enlightenment philosophy. And his from his essay, What is Enlightenment? Is he says, dare to know. So that's a great Enlightenment philosophy. It seems like this great statement of the Enlightenment, dare to know. And yet Kant turns around and in his big abstract works on epistemology, he ends up saying, and this is another quote from him, he ends up saying that he found it necessary to deny reason in order to make room for faith. And how he ended up denying reason. Now, if people say, oh, that's a mistranslation, it's either denying reason or limiting reason. There are different translations you could do from the German, but the basic idea is he wanted to wall off reason into its own little domain, but I imagine from you by putting in a domain that is outside of the reach of reason and can't be challenged by reason. Now, the idea that religion is within the realm of reason and it has to be examined by the use of reason was a central tenet of the Enlightenment, and that's exactly the rug he was trying to, you know, he was trying to pull the rug out from under the Enlightenment in that central way by saying that you had to limit reason in order to make room for faith and creating this separation between faith and reason. Now, he didn't actually succeed in preserving religious faith because, you know, religious faith actually continues to fade after his time. He didn't actually preserve Christianity as he was attempting to do, but he created trying to limit reason. He did succeed in convincing people limited in it. You can't really end up, you know, sort of getting the worst of both worlds of Christianity, but he did undermine reason. And that's an argument that persists to today. And so it's something I've noticed that if you go to, you know, people who are sincerely attempting to defend reason. So I just recently did a review of C's book, which is called Rationality. And it's supposed to be about going over all the different can use reason and a defense in favor of the idea that we should be using reason. What was that?
You just cut out. You're back.
Okay. So, and I noticed in Pinker there, and in some, a lot of these other people, there's a reluctance. It's very typical. A reluctance to come out and simply say, you know, reason is valid because that's the way the world is. Because metaphysically, we can look out, we can see it's self-evident. You know, there's a reluctance to do what Ayn Rand did and say, reason is valid because A is A, because things are what they are. That's just the way the world is, right? So in another example for this that I came across is Jonathan Rauch wrote a very good book called The Constitution of Knowledge. Lots of valid and interesting and legitimate things in it. But when it comes to saying why is reason valid, he accepts this idea, as he put it, that we can't really know the real world out there. All we know is the world as it appears from within our own, you know, from within our own perspective, as distorted by our different biases and opinions. And this creates a problem. And so we have to come up with a way to sort of come up with a ham-handed indirect defense of reason. Say it's just, you know, reason is valid because this is just the way the world is, because A is A. He has to say, well, our consciousness is distorted. All of our views are distorted. We could be completely wrong, but maybe if we work together collectively as a group, we'll correct each other's errors enough that we can come to a reality. Now, why does he have to go through all this sort of hemming and make all these concessions about how we can't really know? And I love this phrase, the real world out there. Well, it's because that argument that he's using is directly from Kant. He probably doesn't realize it, but it comes directly from Kant. The idea that, and the telling phrase there is the real world out there, So it's this idea that we're all trapped into our brain, in our brains, in our own little world of illusions. And there's a real world out there somewhere, you know, separate from us. But all we can see is the world as it appears to us. That is the argument. And the Kantian argument is that the world as it appears to us is, because it's just the world as it appears to us, it is necessarily distorted and filtered by our consciousness. Now, before this, you know, Kant was the first woke philosopher, because this is the basic premise that you need to get to what you call political correctness or wokeness today, which is this idea that, you know, because you're, if you, because I'm a white, a straight, cis hetero, a straight, cis white male, therefore I perceive the world only in ways. Your personal identity is so way that someone from a different background with a different identity would understand it. That's the essence of wokeness, and that all goes back to this Kantian idea that, you know, there's the real world out there, but we're all stuck in our little distorted bubble created by our own identities. And so the first thing I think we need to do to fix the Enlightenment is we need to totally challenge at the root that idea. And I think that's one of the key contributions that Ayn Rand has made in terms of sort of reclaiming or providing a better foundation for Enlightenment ideas, is that she came up with a sort of definitive rejoinder to that argument. And her rejoinder, her famous, her best, most succinct phrase of it, she says, Kant's theory is the idea that we are blind because we have eyes, deaf because we have ears, have a mind. So you see how it's, you know, it's this ridiculous assumption that our means of perceiving the world, that a means of perceiving the world are with the world, not what separates us from being able to understand the world. And specifically, she went behind that and challenged this idea. She says that the assumption behind this Kantian idea that the means by which we perceive the world must distort it is the idea that the perfect means of the perfect perception, a perfectly accurate consciousness of the world, would have to have no means by which it occurs. It would have to happen by no intermediary factors. There have to be no means by which we understand the world, no mechanisms. It would just have to happen through some sort of mystical intuition. And she pointed out that, you know, the other great formulation she gave is she said, nobody would say that because we have to digest food, that true eating and true nutrition is impossible. And she says, similarly, the mind has an identity, it has a process, it has a method which by which it operates, excuse me. And that just as we have to go through a process to digest our food, we have to go through a process to digest knowledge. And that's normal and that's natural, and that's not an argument against knowledge. It's exactly how we should expect the gaining of knowledge to work. So we need to sort of get past that Kantian argument and go back to the point where we can quote Ayn Rand or quote Ayn Rand quoting Aristotle and say reason is valid because A is A, things are what they are. That's just nature of the world, and we are capable of perceiving that directly. So that's the first thing I think we need to fix about the Enlightenment, is to challenge that sort of radical, that implicit radical subjectivism of the Kantian viewpoint, and get to the point where we can actually just go out and affirm that we are capable of perceiving the world. And you know, that things are what they are, that we're able to gain knowledge of that. All right. So the second, and that would sweep away, you know, part, and that, well, now Kant's worst fears would be realized, which is that if we don't deny knowledge, then we won't be making room for faith. So that would be bad for the anti-Enlightenment forces, the religious obscurantists, the people on the religious right who are anti-Enlightenment. But it would also sweep away the woke anti-Enlightenment viewpoint, which is, you know, that no, we can't really know anything about the world. Our knowledge is distorted by our personal identity and by race, class, and gender, etc. All right, so the second big thing that we need to fix about the Enlightenment is we need to reclaim the idea of rational self-interest. Now, rational self-interest actually was a widely accepted moral philosophy in the Enlightenment. And you know, one of the claims I hear often made, especially by conservatives, about the Enlightenment is they say, well, the Enlightenment, they set out to try to find a secular morality and they never succeeded. And it's sort of like, ha, see, that just shows that you need religion to have morality. This is the religious conservative argument. Well, yeah, my research and in the last 5 to 10 years, I've really come to appreciate this, has led me to the conclusion that actually the Enlightenment did develop a secular, what is essentially a secular morality. And it was a morality of rational self-interest. And this, but the problem is that this was done under the cover of religion, or under the rubric, under the aegis of religion. There was actually a widespread viewpoint known as natural religion. And so I mentioned before that the idea that religion should be that religious questions as questions of God and faith should be subjected to rational inquiry was a central idea of the Enlightenment. Well, natural religion was the way by which they did that. So natural religion, to explain the term, was opposed to revealed religion. So revealed religion was the idea that having mystical visions and then relating them to you, that's revelation, that's revealed religion. Natural religion, by contrast, is when you try to picture of God and what God wants for us by observing nature, you know, by observing human nature, by observing the world, and trying to infer from, well, if since God created the world and God created man, we can infer from the nature of the world and from human nature what kind of creature, you know, what God must be and what he must want for us. Legitimately conclusion. But what that did, that idea of natural religion, what it did, that Enlightenment version of religion, what it did is it allowed people to actually come up with what was essentially a secular moral, and it was a morality of self-interest. It was the idea that certain things will tend to make us happy and lead to, you know, flourishing and success in our lives, and certain things will tend to make us miserable and cause us pain. And therefore, that's we can use reason to figure out which things will make us happy and which things will make us miserable, and then do the things that will make us happy, come up with the rules for living, how we can live in a way that will make us happy and allow us to live in peace and prosperity with our fellow man. And then also come up with rules that will keep us from making errors that will lead to pain and suffering. So this is essentially a secular morality, the idea that happiness and misery are the main goals, you know, the thing you want to achieve, the thing you want to avoid, and that you're using reason to understand what rules you should follow, what guidance you should have in order to achieve happiness. That is essentially a secular, this worldly morality, but it was developed under the heading of natural religion. And so what happened is that, as you know, my theory in this, I'm still doing research on this, as you get in the 19th century, what I think happens is that the people who want to stay religious, you know, if you're really dedicated to religion, you don't like this halfway, you know, it's this natural religion was this halfway position between a religious outlook and a secular outlook. And so what happened is it was reluctant by the people who wanted to really rejected by them in faith. And now what the secular people did then in the 19th century is a whole bunch of them substituted society or the state for God and had basically, as Auguste Comte put it, and rejected the philosophy of self-interest. And then the people who were really committed to keeping religion didn't want to go halfway to a secular viewpoint. They reclaimed, you know, they reclaimed that old time religion. And they said, no, we should do this all on faith and on faith and scripture alone. And we should, you know, reject this. The God of the philosophers is just gumming things up, right? So this is the idea that, you know, the philosophers using philosophy and reason to talk about God, that's getting in the way of the real faith, which comes from revelation and from the Bible. All right, so that faded away, and people sort of, you know, so you hear now people saying, well, that in the Enlightenment, they had a secular morality, and that's because they developed one that wasn't recognized as such and was promptly sort of abandoned and forgotten. So we need to reclaim of a morality of self-interest. And specifically, you know, they use terms for it like self-interest properly understood or enlightened self-interest. But I think rational self-interest is the best term because it implies, you know, by what means is self-interest properly understood? By what means is it enlightened? Well, it's enlightened by the use of reason. And it emphasizes the idea that, you know, a rational self-interest is not just doing whatever you feel like. It is observing the world and coming up with rules and principles of morality. So reclaiming the idea of a morality of rational self-interest, I think, is a crucial idea to if we're going to have an Enlightenment 2.0. Those are the two big things. Defending a better defense, a better, firmer foundation for reason, and reclaiming the idea of a morality of self-interest are the two big things I think we need for a second Enlightenment, and, you know, a better foundation for rational self-interest, one that gets rid of the sort of religious dressing that was put on it in the Enlightenment. But the last thing I want to mention, and one that I think is really the absolutely unique contribution of Ayn Rand to the Enlightenment, and that is that, I came across this perspective partly by trying to understand why is it everybody thinks Ayn Rand is a Nietzschean. Right, because you can see some superficial similarities, but there's so many differences between her and Nietzsche in their philosophy that even people who are not completely superficial thinkers still trip up over this. And I think the reason is because they see the similarity in style, in the poetry and the sense of life between Ayn Rand and Nietzsche. And this, you know, and that was what she herself saw. She said, you know, Nietzsche had this tremendous sort of, as a poet, this tremendous ability to project a view of human self-esteem. I think she meant self-esteem, not just individual self-esteem, but self-esteem for, you know, the greatness of human potential. And more widely, what she saw in the romantic, you know, the romantic movement of the 19th century was both a literary movement and also a philosophical movement. And in its essence, it was anti-Enlightenment. The romantics were what made them romantics, the romantic part, the belief in emotion over reason, that your wild, uncontrolled emotions put you in touch with a deeper reality than the cold logic of reason. But by doing that, by embracing that emotional aspect of life, they also sort of cornered the market on the idea of, this idea of having a rich internal spiritual life, of having a sense of personal greatness and the grandeur of your own internal thoughts and internal personal identity, and this sense of adventure and excitement in life, right? So, you know, the romantic literature that came from that, I'll emphasize all of those characteristics. So you had Byron and all these things, you know, all these people creating this great, exciting literature with this very sort of grand sense of life, of the excitement and adventure of life, that was produced as part of this movement that was anti-Enlightenment. So what I think is most interesting about Ayn Rand, that she contributed, her entirely in its content is entirely in the tradition of the Enlightenment. It is entirely pro-Enlightenment. It's pro-reason, pro-individual rights. It's individualist. It is, it emphasizes things like, you know, production and trade as the most important activities in life, as opposed to warfare or art or you know, the crazy artist kind of viewpoint that was typical of the Enlightenment. But at the same time, it has all the excitement and adventure and the liveliness of Romanticism. So it has the sense of life of Romanticism, the actual philosophical content of the Enlightenment. And I think that's the last ingredient the Enlightenment needs to sort of take off and to revive itself, is this sort of reclaiming the excitement that comes from the romance, from this, the art and the sense of life of the Enlightenment, reclaiming that for a pro-reason, individualist, pro-technology, pro-progress outlook. Overview there, and I think you're open up for questions and comments.
Great. Lots of rich material. I tried to take notes as we were going. But for now, I'll defer to JP. Thanks for joining us. I know you've been waiting.
Hi, Scott. Thank you for inviting me to the room. Robert, you gave today a couple of angles to my previous understanding on how the United States, at some point during the early years of its founding, her finding, I think you say, sorry, English is not my first language, but
that's fine.
Of her founding, this ethic of rational self interest was prevalent, and I've studied under a Uruguayan professor that holds a theory of fusionism that speaks of the many, well, they turn more to the Bible as being the original liberal text, which is very far out for me, which is something that I never accepted. But this ethic that was embedded in the American culture in the very early years came from Calvinism. Can you confirm that that's the case? And the other is, the last one is an observation. You're very much talking about an objectivist future. Are you being modest?
Well, I mean, the ideas that I'm saying are needed to fix the Enlightenment are basic objectivist ideas.
Yeah, let's call it that then.
Okay, so you want to take on Calvinism, right? I have to hear the argument for a while it's based on Calvinism. I really strongly doubt it. Calvinism was part of this sort of let's return to the old time religion. It was not a natural religion outlook. It was very much of an appeal to faith. And now I think where people get this, because you know, this was planted deeply by a guy named Max Weber, who was a German philosopher and a social scientist, who came with this idea of the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, this famous title of his famous work. Somehow it was Calvinism that promoted the work ethic, and that somehow was at the basis of capitalism. And I've never really seen that. I mean, it doesn't bear out in American history, because, you know, it was not primarily Calvinists who were at the basis of forming this sort of American outlook. And in fact, so one of the things I would recommend, a friend, I find this a very interesting thing, and a friend of mine is the one who turned me on to this. He's done some good work writing about Jonathan Mayhew, who was a New England preacher in the 1750s and 60s, who was a really important figure leading up to the American Revolution. He died before it happened, so he's not considered a founding father because he didn't make it that far. But he was very influential founding fathers, John Adams, for example. And the interesting thing is he came around along in Boston among the sort of Calvinist Puritan, the existing Calvinist Puritan establishment there. And he became extremely influential, but at first he was shunned because he had these Enlightenment-influenced natural religion views that he basically, the Lockean, the views he had gotten from John Locke and from the Enlightenment philosophers. So the thing is, he had, in order to promote those ideas, though, he had to first overcome the opposition of the Calvinist establishment among the New England, the leftover from the Puritans who settled New England. So it was very much not a Calvinist viewpoint. It was for example, I think Jonathan Mayhew was actually slightly related, like a great nephew or something like that, of Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards was one of these Calvinist from the early days in New England, and his famous speech is that we are all sinners in the hands of an angry God. You know, and we should all view ourselves as inherently depraved and needing to seek forgiveness for our sins. And it was this very puritanical, very Calvinist outlook. And, you know, made the exact opposite kind of theology to him. And it was very that, no, you know, God gave us reason and he gave us the ability to enjoy life and to feel pleasure. And therefore, we should use that, our faculty of reason, use it to examine even all the questions of religion. And we should use that to, in order to be happy here in our lives on this earth. And it's a very different from the puritanical Calvinism. But I think that sort of Max Weber thing of, oh, well, Calvinism, the Puritanism of Calvinism created this sense of a work ethic, and the work ethic is important to capitalism. And it's just, I find it to be a very superficial. Many years ago, probably 23 years ago, I'm thinking, John Ridpath, an objectivist, he's passed away since then, but an objectivist historian, did, I thought, a very good lecture on this idea of Max Weber and the Protestant ethic theory of capitalism, and sort of found that his conclusion was that there's no there. But that might be available somewhere. You should look and see if that's available somewhere online. I'm not sure if it is or not.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. Lawrence.
Hi, Rob. My question is, I guess, one thing that I see sort of happen today is, especially among the non-theistic, or these people who they say they're rationalists. They believe in the data, and I think I don't really know how to classify these people, but they're sort of like the same group that believe in sort of the evolutionary biology or evolutionary anthropology, where they're stating, oh, well, the reason we do X thing is because our evolution has dictated such, where they're more just focusing on just observation and sort of stating causality, but they don't really go much deeper with the practice of reason. So like, they would just say the brain is just chemicals firing, but that's discounting, you know, the brain is so much more powerful and everything, you know. So they seem to ignore romanticism and the sort of higher levels of thought that we would talk about. I don't really know how we would classify them, but they say we're part of the new rational group that's going to be sort of pushing forward. We're all about data, science, and rationality, but that's different from what you've talked about. How would you approach those types of
people? Yeah, that's interesting. And it's a good reminder to me that I got to do an upcoming clubhouse on evolutionary psychology, because this is just everywhere. I mean, Stephen Pinker's into it. And a lot of, you probably have noticed it, there's a bit of a sort of a tech bro angle to this, right? Because I think this idea that, oh, well, everything's because we can explain everything by how we're programmed by our evolutionary, and we do game theory to show how we're programmed by our evolutionary pressures to do this or that other thing. It's very, I don't want to be too glib about it, but I found this very pop kind of guy who's like a Silicon Valley programmer type, comfortable with anything that can be reduced to a program, right? Anything can be reduced to code, like, put the right input and you get the right output. The dealing with life that he's comfortable with. And so I think the Silicon Valley types, there's this appeal of, okay, we've cracked the code. Everything is software. Everything is code, including human behavior. It's all just code. And if we understand the how we were programmed by our evolutionary background, then we'll understand everything, including also was like behind said, you know, including how do you get women to sleep with you? Well, there's a code, and if you just follow the right inputs, you know, the women will fall at your feet. It generally doesn't work out terribly well for them, but there was this fad there for a while. But you see that sort of outlook, and what they're doing is, this is part of, I think this is a, now this is very indirectly, but it's, I think it's part of the Kantian legacy, that when Kant said, I mean, the limit reason in order to make room for faith, what he did is he basically said, well, reason is good. The way this came down into the is reason is good for dealing with scientific and technical
you're cutting out.
Okay. The big questions of life, what you should do, feelings and love, all that sort of stuff, that's not the realm of reason. That's the realm to make room for faith. Down to, in terms of the public's understanding, and I think the types that you're talking about, and I've encountered many of them too, it's like they accepted that, yes, Kant is right, this Kantian outlook is right, reason is good for understanding scientific and technical stuff, and therefore that must be all, and since we're in favor of reason, that must be all there is to life. And we're just going to dismiss everything out. Instead of using reason to apply, instead of saying reason also applies to issues of love and to the big philosophical questions and to the meaning of life and all, instead of saying we should apply reason to that, we're going to dismiss all of that as irrelevant and as meaningless and as sort of an epiphenomenon. And we're just going to, the stuff that Kant said it was okay to apply reason to, we're going to assume that's all of life. And we're going to reduce everything in life to that. So it's all, you know, well, since reason can be used to understand the technical scientific issues of evolution, therefore all of life can be explained by evolutionary psychology. Now, like I said, I've got to set aside another clubhouse to sort of present my full case against evolutionary psychology. I think the essence of, in a sentence or so, is that they want to basically reduce everything to how we were programmed by evolution. Our brains were programmed and hardwired in certain ways, while ignoring the fact that the whole evolutionary brain, the whole programmed, because it is self-programming. They want to act as if we are programmed and exactly, we are evolutionary programmed. Mollusk is evolutionarily programmed. So it's like they have this, what seems superficially to be an evolution, a point based on evolution, but ignoring the one like evolutionary superpower that humans have, you know, the one thing that gave us evolutionary advantage. Self-programming, and they want to sort of throw that out. So that's my like very brief case against evolutionary psychology.
Well, I'll look forward to that episode. You know, when you brought up Kant, I'm curious. I mean, you know, when people like Pinker or others are fighting for a new enlightenment, I mean, do they mean partially the version in which Kant has a part in it?
Well, one of these guys who's sort of the devil's thing about Kant is because he wraps up a lot of his philosophy in being part of the Enlightenment, right? And presented himself that way. And when he said, you know, I'm going to deny knowledge in order to make room for faith, he also sort of repackaged that as, well, then I'll put this on a firmer foundation by showing exactly where it's appropriately applied, right? Now, he's undermining reason the whole time, and he's pretty clear that he actually wants to undermine reason. It's not just our imagination, but he manages to sort of spin that in a way. Well, basically he's destroying the village in order to save it, right? I'm limiting reason in order to save it, but really what he's doing is he's completely undermining reason and not really being about that. So he managed to and that's actually one thing I was going to end with. I forgot to do this. The one thing that's good about Kant is when he says, dare to know. And that spirit that he captured in that of saying, we should want to be using our minds to understand the world. We should want to dare to know and to view no obstacles to our ability of our minds to understand and deal with the world. That is the basic spirit of the Enlightenment we should be trying to reclaim. But the problem is Kant sort of presented himself as one of the advocates of that, while on the fundamental he was totally undermining it. And you know, that's across all. I'm gonna have to also do another clubhouse one of these days. There was another philosopher who referred to Kant as the all destroyer. And I, so I have to do one on how Kant was the all destroyer. He mean everything from morality to art, he ruined it. So, you know, he's sort of the last, he's sort of viewed as the last enlightenment. And my view is he's the last one because he killed it.
That's funny. Well, I'm glad we're starting to get these scheduled. I have to admit, I cheated a little bit and I went to your Substack. There's a lot of good information on there, but you wrote a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago. And one of the things you quote, you say there are crucial spots where Pinker's defense of the validity of reason is undercut by a type of metaphysical shyness, and that it's common. And I just, you know, I wonder if some people just, they're trying to make a distinction between that kind of Spock-like, you know, no emotion and the other side of the dichotomy, or they don't want to miss out on the, you know, creativity of intuition, or, you know, what you might see in artists.
Yeah, I see that. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the impetuses behind the clash against the Enlightenment was, oh, this is a narrow view, and you know, if we do everything by reason. Now, I'm glad you mentioned Spock, because he's the guy who encapsulates. So when I talked about this idea of trying to unify romantic, what's good about romanticism, take all the exciting and interesting parts about romanticism and combine them with a pro-reason philosophy, integrate them within a pro-reason enlightenment, essentially enlightenment content of the philosophy. Well, first of all, no, you know, I've gone to many clubhouses without talking about. And you brought this up. I have to keep it. Spock is a great example of how deeply internalized that false alternative has become. So you know that when people came to the idea of what would be at the ultimate example of reason and logic applied to human life. Gene Roddenberry says, oh, well, let's create the Vulcans. Let's create Spock, a guy who has gone through this, you know, this spiritual discipline of totally purging himself of all emotions. And I think maybe this also speaks to what I was getting at when talking to Lawrence about the people who think of themselves as rationalists and who want to explain everything away as evolutionary psychology. It's the same sort of thing, that they have this Spock-like caricature of what reason is, that, you know, if reason is to purge yourself of emotions or to detach yourself from emotions or to explain emotions away as a reflection of some underlying evolutionary programming, that, you know, that say, explain them away in terms of something that's non-emotional, right? And that comes from this sort of leftover idea of a separation between the emotional aspect of life and the rational aspect of life, that I think is one of the uncorrected problems and sort of change from the misunderstanding of reason that we need to change from the Enlightenment. And rather what we think we need to have is the idea that you can integrate reason and emotion. And that's, you know, the other big thing that Ayn Rand did is her view of the emotions is that your emotions are a sort of automatized version of your prior thinking, your prior assumptions about life, your prior evaluations of the world and all the things in it and your place in the world. All that's stored away in your subconscious and produces automatized results. And that, you know, not only that this is actually a good thing, it's worthwhile, it's valuable, but at the same time, it can produce inappropriate reactions and inappropriate responses that you need to be able to analyze by reason. And one of the things I think is actually very hopeful today and would be a crucial part of an Enlightenment 2.0 is this viewpoint has actually become a very common and widely accepted one under the name of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's actually becoming the dominant theory in psychology, is this idea to change your emotional reactions and your psychological reactions. You need to understand the thinking that created that and then change your thinking patterns and thinking methods in order to counteract that. And it's been tremendously successful. And I think that's why it's becoming more dominant. So I think that needs to be integrated, and more broadly, the idea that the emotional, that art and literature and creativity also needs to be brought sort of within the, needs to be integrated with reason. Now that wouldn't leave room, it wouldn't mean there's no room for, you know, it's the Spock-like view that says, oh, that would leave no room for creativity or spontaneity or for, you know, for going on your gut feeling or anything like that. When actually, I think a non-Spock-like approach, one that tries to integrate reason and emotion, would understand that, you know, creativity and spontaneity and your quote-unquote gut feeling is you properly using and taking advantage of the automatic operations of your subconscious, that your subconscious is not a force opposed to reason, but that it's complementary with reason. But anyway, that's a whole other topic for another day, probably too.
Third show topic.
Yeah.
Keith, thank you for joining us.
The thing about these big issues, though, just make one sentence. The thing about these big issues is, every time you touch one, it's connected to a whole bunch of other ones. And so every time we start having one of these discussions, I come up with four more topics we can spend an hour talking about.
Go ahead, Keith.
But go ahead.
Thank you, guys. Rob, you know, Ayn Rand talked a lot about having the need for a second renaissance. And I was wondering, yeah, is there something useful in thinking in terms of a second renaissance in order to get to an Enlightenment 2.0? Or is there really no distinction there?
Yeah. Well, actually, the original way she talked about a second renaissance, I'm not sure she talked so much about a second renaissance, but it came to be sort of adopted as a bit of a slogan. And, you know, the objectivist, you know, pre-Amazon, you know, back in the days pre-Amazon, if you want a specialty subject, you got a special catalog, you know, delivered to you know, you got a catalog delivered to your mailbox where somebody would gather together a bunch of books on that. So, was called Second Renaissance Books. And so the idea of a second renaissance, it became sort of a slogan. Now, the funny thing is when Ayn Rand actually used that phrase, it was, I think Ellis Wyatt has it in Atlas Shrugged, where he says, we're going to have a second renaissance. He's talking about an industrial renaissance. Paintings is going to be oil derricks, is his way of putting it. So she meant a little something different by it when she first used the phrase. But it came to sort of stand for the idea of a revival of pro-reason ideas. And the interesting thing I found about this, when Ayn Rand wrote, she never talked about the Enlightenment one way or the other. She didn't say bad things, say good things about it. She actually says some things about the post-Renaissance era, the Enlightenment era, but she never uses the phrase. And I'm curious, I don't really fully myself know why. I'd like to track that down, see if anybody has any definitive answer to that. It could simply be intellectual fashions. The idea of referring to the 18th century as the Enlightenment was something that was not really common until fairly late in the 19th century. It could be that, you know, in her education of philosophy in Russia in the, you know, 1910s and 20s, this was not a phrase, this was not a way of looking at things that she encountered. So she thought of the Renaissance, and then there's the post-Renaissance era. But the idea of the Enlightenment as being a separate era and having it certainly didn't have the profile in her mind that it has, especially now. So as to the value of which term to use, a second Renaissance or second Enlightenment, I love the idea of a Renaissance, of a rebirth. But I'm going with Enlightenment partly because, first of all, I think the ideals of the Enlightenment than the Renaissance. And I'm looking at this time in this. But the Renaissance was a sort of a rebirth of all classical knowledge, but it was everything from the classical world, right? It was Aristotle. I mean, Aristotle was the driving force. It was the thing that made the Renaissance special. But if you look at the Renaissance thinkers, they were reviving Aristotle. They were reviving Plato. They were reviving everything from the classical world. And it didn't have as much of a direction, right? It was just the excitement of rediscovering all these ideas that had been buried for 1,000 years under this sort of obscurantism of Western Christianity. specifically, you know, and the Dark Ages, specifically in Western Europe. And so the Enlightenment has, I think, more specificity to it, that there was more of a sense of, okay, specifically the idea of science. And it was the point at which we were just trying to revive, but we had gone beyond Aristotle and we had discovered all these amazing new things. And we had, you know, the whole Newtonian physics, and we were able to understand the movement of the planets of the solar system and all of that. It was this, you know, science had developed to this tremendous new advances and tremendous new ability to explain the world. So it had gone beyond just the revival of the classical world to become something new, and opening these new vistas of, like, we can go beyond that and do even more than the ancients ever did. But it also had a greater specificity, and, you know, the idea specifically of immorality of rational self-interest. Right, that's something that went beyond what had been done before and was more specific than just a revival of classical learning. So that's why I lean towards the Enlightenment. And then there's the simple practical thing that the Enlightenment is kind of looming large in the imagination, you know, among the sort of intellectual classes, among people who read books by Stephen Pinker and that kind of thing, among the sort of middle to highbrow range of American political discussion. The Enlightenment is looming very large. It also, I found it also looms very large in the minds of the opponents of our ideals. So I've had a lot of run-ins. Well, on the woke set, they'll say, "Oh, the Enlightenment was all racist, and it was really all about finding scientific theories of racism, and that's what the Enlightenment was about." Or if you go to the religious right types, they hate the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was the era of Voltaire. It was the era of atheism. It was the era that dethroned religion from its central role in life. And they hate the Enlightenment too. So I think for a whole bunch of reasons, I think it's the right label for the kind of outlook that we're looking for.
Great. Tom, quick question.
Yes, I just want to make a comment to what Rob just said about why Rand may not have used the term the Age of Enlightenment, because I think that another term, maybe a different time range, was used more by her, at least according to my objectivist CD-ROM search, and that term is the Age of Reason. And so, in a way, she uses that a little more, maybe, than all the other terms, because it addresses the essence of this Renaissance, all right, rebirth of reason. Yeah. So the Age of Reason comes after that, and so that's I think is probably the reason.
Yeah, I think the Age of Reason was also in the early to mid 20th century was a more common way of referring to the era that we call the Enlightenment now.
Great.
Tremendously influential series of books on the history on intellectual history by a guy named Will Durant, The Story of Civilization by Will Durant. And he, I remember, the Age of Reason.
Right. Great. Well, this has been a great conversation, and it probably sparked three or four new Clubhouse sessions in the future. Tomorrow at a special time, 1 p.m., the Atlas Society Asks will have Jag interviewing well-known rapper, fitness expert, and Liberty Movement phenom Zuby. On Clubhouse back here tomorrow at 7 p.m. Eastern, Professor Jason Hill will discuss the case for colonialism and objectivist inquiry. And also tomorrow, Professor Stephen Hicks is continuing his series on education's heroes and villains, this one on Kant and absolute duty. Friday on Clubhouse at 4 p.m. Eastern, Richard Salzman will be here on the topic of recession, essence, cause, and cure. And we do have our gala coming up October 6th in Malibu, honoring Michael Saylor. We're going to have panels with the scholars during the day. It should be a lot of fun. Thank you, Rob, for doing this topic. Thanks to everyone who participated, and we'll see you all next time.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care.